Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are digital strategist Winter Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Journalist Margaret Wappler.
Hi there, Guy.
Hello, Margaret. Academic and DJ Oliver Wang.
Hello, Guy.
The Facebook group suggested a new title for you. Did you see that?
Yes, I vetoed it.
You vetoed it?
You already hated on it.
What is it?
Was it what was it?
Jackademic? No, it was AcaDJ.
AcaDJ.
It sounds like a bad pun from Pitch Perfect 3 or something.
Understandable. You guys, every week we start the show by taking a question from a listener about our own pop culture taste. This week, I want you guys to tell me, what's the widest or most notable discrepancy between the picture you created in your head of a person based solely on hearing their voice, be it music, podcast, radio, etc., and what they actually look like? Oliver.
So I was thinking about this, and it wasn't a musical artist, because I think as someone who grew up in the MTV generation, I pretty much knew what every artist looked like at some point. But it was definitely public radio. It was Michael Krasny, for folks who are from the Bay Area. He hosts the morning talk show, interview show on KQED up there. And I think this is a classic thing that happens with public radio hosts. It's not like you have an exact image, but it doesn't matter what you think they look like. Inevitably, they will never look like whatever the amorphous thing you think they might have looked like.
What does he look like?
Krasny looks like – well, the picture they have up of him up on the KQED website, I feel like it's from like the 1990s or something, because apparently he looks much younger than he actually is. But he looks like sort of, thin face, mustache. Like, he just doesn't look like his voice. I just assume it would be someone who carried themselves with somehow more gravitas in a physical sense. I mean, I still think that when he was at his prime, he was one of the best to do it in terms of just as an incisive, public radio interviewer. I haven't heard him in 10 years because I haven't lived up there. But it just, for whatever reason, I just thought he would look more like, classic maybe – evening news from the 1980s kind of thing or something like that. In terms of new people, and this is literally, I think, yesterday, I was listening to an interview with Randall Park. Actually, it was this morning. It was Randall Park being interviewed on Fresh Air by Anne-Marie Baldonado, who's usually one of the producers for the show, and I've never heard her host or do an interview.
Uh-huh.
And for some reason, I just imagined that her voice – so this is a reverse, right?
Oh, that's funny.
I imagine her voice would be like kind of deeper – and, more like
– NPR voice?
Yes, exactly. And it's not at all. And so
what
I was sort
it?
Of like – it's, it's a little bit higher pitched and more – I mean, it's not classic NPR. It's new NPR voice.
Well, it's funny. One of the conversations that was on Facebook this week was about NPR voice and do we NPR voice. And I think it's weird because you're like trying to seem like – we started this like at the time that the conversation about NPR voice started, and – I definitely know that I was like somebody who always in my head intellectually was like, you talk in a way that couldn't be on This American Life. Like, you just have too much emotion and you're not doing the self-serious thing. But the thing is there are ways, like when I subbed in for Jesse, I like was trying to be like, serious, like
Margaret called that, I think, right?
Yes. Look, everything's a performance. One of mine was also an NPR person. It was Audie Cornish, who I always interpret all NPR people, all NPR women, as being sort of like solidly built high school principals.
Yes.
And that was just, I had filed her along with so many of these people. And then what was funny is I heard her on Pop Culture Happy Hour, where she just had the freedom to talk about stuff, and I didn't realize that she was black. And then I went online, and she was much younger than I thought she would be, and she's much more attractive than I thought she would be, and she's black. And my other one is also racial. It is Amy Winehouse, because I went into it, and the first time I heard her, I was like, all right, black British girl, braids, 22. Like, the thing I think I knew was that she was 22. And so I was thinking sort of like baby-faced, and then once somebody was like, no, she's Jewish. Then suddenly I went to I'm essentially imagining Adele before I had seen Adele. And then I saw actual Amy Winehouse and I was like, oh, that was not what I was thinking of. Winner.
Mine is real. It was Phoebe Snow and Michael McDonald.
Hmm.
Like Phoebe Snow, just my mom loves her and she's passed on now, but in my mind, she was like look like Sarah Vaughan, or she looked like Pearl Bailey. Like, she just had, like, this real, like, jolly, you know, older black woman vibe. And then when I saw her, I was like...
What does she look like?
Well, she was a white Jewish woman.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I... And you know, she looks like she might have been mixed. I don't know. Who knows? I'm not going to desecrate and dance on her grave about that. Whatever was going on was going on. But she looked very ethnic, but like, but definitely not like a totally a black person. So maybe half and half. But she was a Jewish white woman. And Michael McDonald, I just, everybody sounded like that then. So everybody that I knew was doing that, like Jeffrey Osborne and James Ingram. I thought he was in that world, sort of like he looks like he could be like an airport clerk, like in the 80s. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Margaret, what about you?
I think the two that I remember being surprised by the most was Terry Gross first. Like, this was a long time ago at this point now, like 15 years ago or something that I first saw her picture. And I was just so surprised that she was like this little strawberry blonde pixie of a woman.
Yeah. She's so much more because
like
she
Sandy
also
Duncan.
I also had her categorized as like high school principal, 30 pounds overweight.
Yeah. She's just so formidable as an interviewer that like I just didn't attach that to this like very petite woman.
Right.
But now when I listen to her voice, I can't not picture that woman.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, like it's completely linked together. Like I can see her like, you know, taking her little red rimmed glasses and like putting them down her nose as she's asking insightful questions. And then the other one is Christina Aguilera for quite the similar reasons that you were talking about with Amy Winehouse, where when I first heard her voice, it was just so big and voluminous that I thought that she must be like a very Zaftig woman.
Yes.
And she's just this little breed of a girl, you know, especially back then in the 90s. And I mean, it just goes to show you cannot really predict anything about voices by size or race or gender or whatever.
The concept of sounding fat is a thing that we don't talk about. But as a fat person, one of my oldest jokes is about how I look fat and sound gay, and I wish I sounded fat and looked gay. but it is like a thing. There are people with those voices where you're just like, oh, that's a big girl right there.
We should have a future group question about which, if on voice alone, who would you want to party with? And the only acceptable answer is Nina Totenberg.
Who is that?
She does the legal affairs thing for NPR.
Yes.
And she always sounds like
she's so much fun recapping
Supreme Court decisions.
From her basement when she fucking takes on the voices of the court members. I love it so much.
I feel like Kai Ryssdal is maybe a crazy man deep down inside.
I think Kai Ryssdal has some – yeah, he's got some secrets.
You know?
There's some – yeah. In fact, the one time I visited NPR, the national office – Kai Ryssdal was in the studio simply recording different versions of him saying, I'm Kai Ryssdal. And it was the most, mesmerizing thing I've ever heard before.
Yeah,
it was amazing.
That sounds special.
Awesome.
Dedication.
Coming up on this week's show, our Pop Rocket Halloween horror movie showdown will be spooky and scary. And we've already threatened Margaret's life enough. So let's not bring up the possibility that one of us will be killed. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Warren Mitchell, what are you all about this week?
I'm really excited for Ricky Gervais to come back as the Golden Globes host. He is strong. I'm not taking anything away from Tina and Amy. But, you know, like, you know what year is going to need to get. And I feel like this is one of those years.
Well, there's something so fascinating about the two of them like being resounding successes over and over again at the Globes and saying, we're not going for the brass ring. We're just going to walk away and say we did this right.
Right.
Which is bold and fascinating.
Bold and fascinating. But then also, like, I missed him. He brings a certain spite and snark to it that's so specific and grinding without going too far.
It's that dry British humor.
Yeah. He's going to grind them, and it's going to be funny because I feel like this year is going to be kind of boring.
Both he and Chris Rock, I think, are going.
Oh.
Oh. Thoughts?
What are your thoughts?
I don't think he should do it.
Why?
I just personally, I liked what Chris did with the last time he hosted the Oscars. I liked it. I didn't love it. And I think that, one, he was brought in because there's going to be no way around the elephant in the room this year. Mm-hmm. I don't know what movies are in contention for, you know, the Globes kind of depict, kind of to tell you what's going to happen at
Straight
the Oscars.
Straight Outta Compton was the first screener we, like, the,
oh, really?
The Writers Guild got. Yeah, they are clearly saying this is an Oscar movie.
Okay, so then you've got, like, I just feel like it's, like, one of those. Mm. But I also told you, like, I have, like, this kind of problem with him right now where I'm trying to figure out, like, post-divorce, like, newly single Chris Rock, like, what does that look like? Because there's always a shift when a man sort of, you know, a comedian, like, breaks off a huge relationship.
It's so many comics we've had to see. Guy, like, it's so weird when you have these guys who are, like, so much of their material is about their marriage.
Right.
Him, Louis C.K.
Exactly.
I mean, even back in the day, Dave Barry. The notion that Dave Barry left his wife, I was like, or whatever the breakdown in their relationship was, I was like, how does he do this anymore?
Yeah. So there's going to be a lot of that coming to the stage. I just like, you know, the Globes is a more fun party. It's a more relaxed party. So, you know, having Ricky there really does it's some justice. It's coming back and, you know, kind of always having a fresh take. Every time he's there, it's a fresh take. It's the same room. He knows the room. Oscars, they went in on Chris Rock last time. Aggressively about a lot of the jokes he made and in defense of Jude Law.
Well, I love that the Oscars is going to have somebody with hard jokes. I just feel like the Oscars is sort of creating a situation that it is an unwinnable situation.
I was going to say that's like the rule is that you perform, you're the host, and then you get ripped apart the next day. That's just what happens.
Here's your gift basket.
Yeah, exactly. Hope he's getting a nice paycheck for it.
Did we not agree in our previous show that Andy Samberg could probably take that role on and survive it relatively unscathed?
No. I don't think he's quite ready. He's not quite ready.
Five more years.
Okay.
Jimmy Fallon. If he stops falling.
Yeah, I mean, if his hands are intact.
That's cold.
If he keeps his fingers intact.
Margaret, what are you all about this week?
I'm all about Rainbow Rowell's new book called Carry On. She is one of the most preeminent YA authors, and she wrote this incredible book that I just reviewed for the New York Times called Carry On that features this very kind of Hogwarts-like school. Mm. And at first you think it's really going to be this kind of ripoff of Harry Potter. And in fact, Rainbow Rowell has always done a lot with like fan fiction in her works. Her last book, Fangirl, there's a character who writes fan fiction. And actually the story of Carry On is taken from Fangirl and then extrapolated out for this whole book. So it's at this Hogwarts Magicians Academy. And it's these two young magicians, Simon and Baz, and they're sort of the odd couple. They live together in their dorm. They're always bickering. Simon is this kind of hot mess of a magician and can't, like, get his spells straight. He's always messing things up and blowing things up and whatever. And Baz is, like, cool as a cucumber and basically seems like he would, you know, hang out with, like, Morrissey back in the day or something. And, like, you know, he's got this black swoopy hair. And the two of them, what's so interesting about this book, in addition to the whole, like, magician's setting, is that the two of them actually end up striking up a relationship. Relationship.
Oh.
Yeah. So it's something you don't – I'm not spoiling it because it's out there about that element at this point. But it's something you don't see coming exactly. But when it happens, you're like, oh, of course.
Oh, I like this.
Yeah. And then the book is just such a joy. It's just really smartly written. It's filled with like all these pop culture references. The title of the book, Carry On, is from the Queen song. And that's one of the main spells in the book that they use. So it's really wonderful. I think it's a great entry point into YA. If you're not a YA reader, this is like a great way to get in.
So would my 10-year-old be into it?
She might be a little too young. I would say like in 2 years.
Okay.
I have two little questions and a big question.
Yeah.
First little question is, do you get tired of female authors writing, like, because this female sidekick's name is Penny, right?
Yeah.
Do you get tired of female authors continuing to place men at the center of narrative?
You know, because it takes this turn in their relationship, and because Penny plays quite a big role in it too, it doesn't feel unfair to me. I think with Rainbow Rowell's books, and when you look at them as a whole, she's written plenty of very well developed female characters.
Second little question is, my trouble reading YA is that generally they set up an interesting world and don't get through much of a plot because they're really stuck at like 180 pages. Like, they're little books.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, God, this is not a little book. This is, like, 550 pages.
Okay. Oh, seriously?
Yeah.
This sounds really good.
Yeah. It's really good.
And also, a couple of times, just the novelty of there being gay YA. I read a couple of them a couple of years ago, and they tended to be the blandest of stories. And the thing is giving us something that is, like...
This is lusty. This is honest to God sexy. Well, like, there's scenes in it that you're like, oh my goodness.
And there's magic. My question was about, you reviewed this and a couple of other things in the New York Times.
Yeah.
And one of my old school favorites that I've talked about on the show before, Mercedes Lackey, had gone from the old school world of sci-fi fantasy that existed in the 80s and is trying her hand at YA because that's what sells right now. And you gave it a pretty, like, mediocre review. Do you feel like she just didn't make the transition well, or is she just getting old?
Well, you know, I feel like she bogged herself down with this Chosen One narrative that felt very Hunger Games, like recycled.
We've seen it before.
Yeah, exactly. It just, she didn't, the coolest thing about that book is that she brought this concept to it of, like, this other world that bleeds into our world that, basically, all of the, like, mythological monsters that we've ever thought of can, like, go into our world now. And it's very cool, but then, like, the characters just don't, there's not much story around the characters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This week, I am all about two little things. One is last week when we recorded the show and I did not show up, it was a Canadian election. That's not why I was gone. I had to work late.
Right, guy.
But
I know the deal.
But the past 80 days were really, really fun for me to get to watch what was for a long time a legit three-way race that ended up turning into a more conventional two-way race. But the thing about it that I really enjoyed the whole time was the CBC's host of Power and Politics, their sort of like daily political show, is this woman named Rosemary Barton, who just is the kind of political reporter that we kind of don't have space for anymore.
Like Candy Crowley?
Kind of like Candy Crowley, just in that she pushed back hard. Like, they had, like, about halfway through the campaign, a little more than that, there was a scandal about basically the Syrian refugees who died. Like, in Canada took that very, very seriously because they were coming to Canada and they're having a discussion about it, and the minister for immigration was like, well, I wish you had had me on this show to talk about it before. And, like, in America, I feel like that would have happened. It would have just fallen like a thud. And then 2 days later, we would have had think pieces that said it was wrong. Mm-hmm. And Rosemary Barton is the kind of journalist who is smart enough and present enough to be like, well, no, actually, here are the times that we had you on before. And she was just
roll tape.
She's a dick to everyone. She was a dick to the prime minister. She was a dick to Thomas Mulcair. Like, it didn't matter what political party you were. She was really, like, when people didn't answer questions, she said, you're not answering this question.
I like it.
And it was really exciting. Yes.
I want to ask you what you think about this Justin Trudeau hotness factor.
Okay. Well, look.
Uh-oh.
I was excited that the Liberal Party of Canada got to come back. I legitimately wanted to see what Canada would do if they've never really had a coalition government before. Mm-hmm. They've had minority governments that relied on smaller parties for periodic support. But I kind of wanted to see the third party, the NDP, show that it could stick around. And that didn't happen. I wanted the Liberals to win. They are good at running Canada. I'm worried for Justin Trudeau. He was a snowboarding instructor not so long ago. Oh. And he's real, real cute. And Canada's a country that
It's Trudeau.
Canada's a country that Canada largely
demerit.
Canada largely doesn't have political charisma. Like, they're just like, oh, you'll be recording secretary of our country. And the last time they really did go crazy for somebody was his dad in 68. And so it will be interesting to see if he can fulfill these promises. It's the Liberal Party of Canada, so they will probably govern fine for 4 years and become so politically corrupt that they are ousted against the goodness of their policies.
Like a Ryan Murphy show.
Yes.
I'm curious to understand, what's your particular interest in Canadian politics?
Oh, my interest in Canadian politics is that it is an attempt to hybridize a British Westminster system and an American federal system in a way that makes no fucking sense.
All right.
Because you have these parties coming out of provinces as protests, but also a first-past-the-post system where whoever gets the most votes wins. In so many of these districts' writings, you had legit four-way races where, like, 75% of the population was not going to get someone they voted for elected. And that allows for just titanic meltdowns. In 93, a party went from having 200 members of parliament to two. Last election, the Liberal Party of Canada went down to 38 members of parliament. Like, shit goes crazy. And they're going to try to fix it this time. They're going to try to move to proportional representation. But it's zany. And as I said, like, no real charisma. Like, it's hilarious. All right. The other thing that I'm excited about is a little bit unexpected, but I'm very excited that the Kansas City Royals made it to the World Series. My friend Ryan has been making me watch baseball, and I then found myself, like, 2 weeks ago just sort of glancing up at a baseball game and paying attention to it, because turns out when there are no disapproving dads involved, I like sports more. Oliver, what are you all about this week?
Well, I just want to second your nod to the World Series, which I think begins – wait, is it tonight or tomorrow night? I should know this. And I thought the Kansas City was actually a really fun team last year. And if it wasn't for the fact that they were going up against the Giants, like, I would have rooted for them just not knowing anything about them except that they seem young and plucky. And I, you know, like young and plucky teams. So we'll see what happens this year around. I'm into three different new podcasts, which I've been listening to for the last few weeks. Two of them are hip-hop related interview shows. One is The Cypher that is hosted by Sean Sataro. And full disclosure, I was interviewed on that show, but I'm not saying this just because of that. The other one is The Combat Jack Show, which I've not been on, so there's no conflict there. And in both cases, I love the thoroughness of the interviews themselves and the kind of candor they get out. And so, for example, I mean, Sean did a really solid show with Master Ace a couple months back. I just listened to a Combat Jack show with Consequence, who was sort of always the kind of B-lister with the Tribe Called Quest. And
I love
Kanye's
him.
Team.
He gets so much shit.
He does. And, you know,
he's great.
He was very candid with talking about his experiences and kind of his frustrations, which is – I just don't – rappers very rarely talk about their vulnerabilities. And I think there's still this shield that comes up. But I think that what I like about these new podcasts is their ability to really elicit candor out of it. And I think at a time in which hip-hop print journalism seems to be really suffering, I think this is now an amazing era for hip-hop podcast journalism, and it's really nice to see.
Any other episodes that you recommend?
I would start. I mean, there was a pretty hilarious one that Combat Jack did with Freddie Fox, actually, who dates all the way back to the Flavor Unit days with Queen Latifah and the 45 King, and that was actually quite entertaining. And then the third podcast is I want to get this title right. It's HuffPost Love and Sex, which is relatively new. I think it's only been around now for about how many episodes have they recorded at this point? I don't know, like 20 or 30 or so. And I've been looking for another kind of love and sex podcast that isn't Savage Love, which I still think is the number one in the category, but just to have something else to listen to. And their host, I can't credit their names, which I apologize about, but they basically have a gay man and a straight woman as the two co-hosts. And each week they pick a
different – This isn't the project that Sandra Doherty is doing, is it?
I don't know.
Can your phone tell you?
Can your phone tell
you? Let's see.
Phones
it is with
– so
no, it's with Noah Michelson and Karina Kolodny.
Oh, Noah. Noah's great.
Okay.
He's my – when I post things to the Huffington Post, he's my editor.
Well, there you go.
Yes.
So, so they've been doing for, I think, maybe about the past year or so, they've been doing a love and sex podcast, which – I find to be well-informed and entertaining. I mean, again, it's not – they're not trying to creep into Dan's territory exactly. They do take it occasionally. They do mailbag shows where they'll answer questions. But each week they take a different theme. And for example, they did a whole week about virginity, which I thought was actually really thought-provoking and interesting. And I've enjoyed it so far.
That's lovely. It was better than your own virginity?
Well, it did make me question exactly when I lost my virginity.
Whoa!
And because it depends on what you define as virginity, right? Oh. And if it's about sort of penetrative, you know, penis and vagina sex, that's one thing. But then, you know, that doesn't apply to people who are queer, for example, necessarily, right? I mean, it really made me reevaluate that really I lost my virginity like one girlfriend earlier than I thought I did. which kind of changes the narrative. You
Congratulations.
Know?
Thank you. All right, you guys, you're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back for our Halloween horror movie showdown after this.
I'm excited. This is Erin from Columbus, Ohio. I listen to Bullseye because every week I am introduced to a new movie, book, song, video game, or idea that I never would have discovered on my own. And I gain new insights into the things I already love. Thanks, Jesse.
I'll talk to director and actress Elizabeth Banks and sit down with the musician Elvis Costello on the next Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
Oliver Wang.
And you guys, the autumn squashes are in, and we all know what that means. That
pumpkin spice lattes for everybody!
America's about to get a whole lot spookier. Welcome to the first annual Festival of Fear here at Pop Rocket. We're going to be talking about the horror movies that scared us out of our wits and possibly made us pee our pants just a little bit or a lot. We'll also be examining what makes a movie genuinely frightening versus schlocky. Let's just open up with what's everybody's, from your gut, scariest movie that you love?
Ooh. I have two.
Okay.
I think it's a tie for me between The Exorcist and Rosemary's Baby.
Okay.
Classics. I love Margaret. Both of them. I know, I stole two good ones.
Okay.
That wasn't what I was going to say.
Why The Exorcist? I mean, and like, both of those are like moodier than they are slashery or horror-y.
That's what I prefer personally for horror movies. I like the moodiness more than I like the slasherliness. Uh-huh. The Exorcist, I think, was the first movie I saw as a pretty small kid. So that just ranks as being the first movie that just scared me to death. Like, watching it late at night with my brothers and, you know, being a religious kid, too, like my dad being a minister and all of the themes in that movie about, like, possession and demonic possession and the devil and, I mean, it just, I like, sort of knew that world on some level, and it scared me on that level too. I remember going to sleep that night and being genuinely, I mean, I was like maybe 8 years old. I was genuinely worried that the devil was going to possess me that night.
But to be fair, your father was an Episcopal minister, so it would have been a very tasteful exorcism.
Sure. Like, yes.
Finger sandwiches afterwards.
Like
maybe a glass of
cream
scotch.
Cheese sandwiches. Yeah.
I saw The Exorcist as an adult. I think I was probably in my late 20s when I first saw it. And what haunted me from it was not the possession itself. It was as the kind of the icon or whatever of a Pazuzu would just show up randomly in the house when you close the door. Mm. That shit, for whatever reason, I can't explain why that freaked me out so much more than watching someone's
kid. So what would show up?
It was sort of like the Pazuzu symbol or icon or whatever.
I don't know what a Pazuzu
that was. It was basically Satan. It was basically the
devil.
Demon. The demon that possessed
what's her name was Pazuzu.
Rosemary.
Yeah, yeah. The scene in that movie where
Linda.
Yeah. The scene in
Hamilton.
That movie when she
–
Linda Blair.
Linda Blair.
Linda Blair. There we go.
When she – it's only in the director's cut, and it's been filmed differently, but the
spider walk. That's creepy,
probably the most creepiest fucking thing in film history. That's just because the director's cut version has the actual sound effects of her, like, of her joints cracking to sort of like get down there.
The sound effects
and
are
the
amazing.
Sound effects, it's just – and it's just disgusting.
And Rosemary's Baby – is so campy. I mean, what Ruth Gordon is doing is almost a comedy performance, but it is really eerie. And I do love the way that she really embraced excessive familiarity by somebody you're not supposed to be friends with as a source of creepiness.
Oh. Yes. And the thing I love about Rosemary's Baby, too, is just the sense of a young woman who is powerless and gets controlled by so many parties around her, including, of course, her own husband. Mm. Like, she has no agency. Mm. And that kind of storyline is really profound to me. Like, that speaks to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think around our-ish age, those things that you saw on television or saw your parents watching on VHS that you really weren't supposed to see have weird power. So there is something about the kind of horror movie that we made in the 70s, like The Omen, that just kind of unsettles me because it reminds me of these things. My grandma would watch these movies. Like the thing that's honestly the scariest to me, I don't know the name of, because I was watching at my grandma's house and I was just like, this is unsettling and cheap. Like in a like big budget movie, you at least know that this shit is going to be settled. But in a low budget movie, like that Cronenberg thing with
Videodrome?
No, the one where the lady keeps having the babies.
Yes, it was just on the other day. The Brood.
The Brood.
Oh,
like that shit is just like I have none of the safety
unreal.
of high production values. I would also like to give a shout out to. There's something about the way that if something scares you when you are a child, mm-hmm. its residual power over mm-hmm. you is
yes.
great.
Mm-hmm.
This is a silly thing to say, but to me, The Dark Crystal is still a spooky movie. Mm-hmm. Because when I saw it for the first time, I was young enough to be fully invested in everything that was going on. And those Skeksis scared me. Like the shit that came out of nowhere. Like that's a really good movie. But
yeah.
it was also like disturbing to me.
Yeah.
And then the other thing was the TV movie of Salem's Lot that happened
yes.
in like the early 80s. I remember it was like a thing of I was supposed to stay in my room because my parents were watching this thing. And you're like, oh, other people are having a good mm-hmm. time. And I like came out of my room and I saw a scene of what was going on and could not fall asleep for weeks afterwards. Mm-hmm. And to this day have the clearest image of this dark thing smashing up through a table.
Okay, I was going to ask you if it's that scene of like the brother hovering out the window, like a vampire
that
brother.
That is the
that
scary
scared
shit.
Me
the
so
shit
much.
Out of me.
But I feel like Stephen King also occupies a huge place yes. in my psyche just because those things were coming out when I was at an impressionable mm-hmm. age. And only now am I able to sort of like respect him as an interesting author.
Yeah.
Because before I was just like, his brand of creepy was so good at making me uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Oliver.
So isn't that, I don't know if there's really any horror movies, at least classically thought of horror movies that I really love because it's not a genre that I'm a big fan of. I'm not one of those people who gets off and being scared like that just doesn't really do it for me cinematically. But there are horror films that I think I'm really fascinated by and a lot of them tend to be more in the sci-fi horror sense of it. So, I mean, the things that I was thinking of would be, and these are not a lot of these are particularly great movies, but like Event Horizon, for example, and the
yeah.
idea that evil exists in like a trans-dimensional space that drives people insane and just sort of the brief flashes that you see of what happens when you've been exposed to that. I find those parts the most interesting, even though as a film as a whole, it's really, really kind of, cliche as a horror film. You know, I mean, the Alien and Aliens films, but I really think those have more of like a combo of sci-fi action horror rather than classically horror.
Yeah.
I mean, I love Aliens, but again, I never really think of that as a horror film as much as I do as an
action
sci-fi.
Movie.
And what was the one that I was thinking? I mean, I really liked Cabin in the Woods, which is kind of sci-fi, sort of supernatural, also comedic and very mm-hmm. self-aware of itself.
I haven't seen it. People keep saying that it is self-aware and I would find it amusing.
The final scene is awesome.
I mean, it's Whedon. I mean, he co-wrote it he did the script. And there was one more I wrote down. Oh, so one of the ones that I watched
Andrew
when
Goddard.
I was... Yes, right. Mm-hmm. The other one that is Prince of Darkness, which is a
John Carpenter movie.
One.
It's a great movie.
And I think it was just this idea that you would have... So the basic plot of it is these people receive a message from the future that warns them that Satan returns in like, I don't know, probably 2015, who knows, mm-hmm. like some Back to the Future shit. But they have to now stop Satan from presenting itself. Why they couldn't get more of a transmission from the future that had better information and maybe more detail, who knows. But I was always intrigued by this and the way in which they represent how Satan's supposed to cross over through this mirror from another dimension. Something about that was just really has haunted me.
Yeah, that's scary.
Yeah.
I'm getting scared just
also because
about
it took place in like that
church.
That church that's supposed to be like in a downtown inner city.
Yeah.
They're supposed to be taken care – they're surrounded right. by – like homeless people and drug addicts and he's kind of materializing it inside these already diseased people.
Yeah.
So it's just horrific to
so
watch.
In many ways it's very similar to Sister Act.
And this is why guy's here.
Exactly.
But what's the scariest movie you like?
One of the scariest movies I like is called The Gate. It came out in like 86, 87. Stefan Dorff's in it, who's now like hawking, you know, vapor cigarettes, whatever. Supposedly he makes a lot of money on it, so kudos to you, Stefan Dorff. Stephen Dorff. But he used to be called Stefan, okay, by the way. Okay. When he was like in the pop magazines, he was Stefan. The movie takes place in like a suburban situation. He's young. He has an older sister. He has a best friend that comes over. They summon Satan through their favorite record by playing it backwards, this hard heavy metal record.
That era.
And then they open a pit to hell in their backyard. Their parents go out of town. The sister's taking care of them. She brings over some boys. And like the pit of hell opens and these little demons are walking out, and then they would like jump together and form like a big demon, and then they would fall apart and like run after each other and grab each other.
Voltron demons, and what's going
on? No, they were literally, it was so fucking scary. One, because we lived in Fairfield, which was like Northern California, and we lived in all these new tract homes, which are now probably 30 years old, but at the time were like 2 years old. Right. And then also it was that whole like suburban, you know, riding bikes, we're just kids, and the idea that you'd be left alone on your own devices, told to be responsible, and then a demon tears your whole shit up. I mean, he destroyed the house, and then the house came back together. But then there's one scene where they think their parents are home, and so the guy was like, oh, the kid, Stephen Dorff's character's like, oh, thank God, mom and dad, and their faces fall off. And I was like, this is some, that movie messed me up. Of everything I've seen horror related, that's one of the ones I can still remember messing me up.
Was Stephen Dorff also in Blade, or am I thinking someone else?
Yeah, he was in that
same
too.
Thing.
All right, what's your biggest fail as horror movies go? I mean, I just saw The Visit, which I mean it was interesting to watch because like Grandma Smells Weird is a solid premise for a horror movie, and we all have this thing of like this lady who you love and you're closely associated with these people, and then but it's also like that first house you get taken to that's not yours, and all of that was really fun. And I just felt like Shyamalan, who's supposed to have some psychological sense. I mean, the thing is he made it Paranormal Activity style, where it was super, super cheap and it looked amazing because the guy is physically good at making like an attractive film, but that he could not follow. Basically, a horror movie needs to connect to human psychology in some way. And like the worst he could give us was, spoiler alert, they weren't the real grandparents. If they were the real grandparents and some of the stuff that they had dangled about the mom's weird relationship with them had gone back to some kind of crazy shit that felt real. If it wasn't just...
we don't speak anymore.
Like, I'm just... Okay, one of the other questions... Margaret wrote these questions. One of the other questions that she asks is, like, what trope are you most tired of? And it wasn't until this moment that I realized, I think the horror trope I am most tired of is, they're crazy. That's not an answer. If they're crazy because somebody molested them, or they're crazy because they're angry about something, or some actual shit went on, give me something to sink my teeth into. Like, this person is crazy, or this person is evil. Like, the devil is better than that.
But this movie actually reminded me of a movie that I really loved growing up called Grandmother's House. It's a super low, it wasn't that low rate. It was like an independent B movie, but it wasn't schlocky. And it was about a pair of kids who go to their grandparents' house, and the psychopath is now in the house. They don't take it that far. They don't do the whole, you know, I'm pretending to be a relative. It just goes straight into the chopping. And but I like the idea of kids running around a big house trying to protect themselves, not feeling safe. That part I was totally into. But the moment the grandparents showed up, I was like, these motherfuckers are not their grandparents.
Right.
Okay?
Margaret and Oliver, super fails for you or just tropes that you hate?
Well, I don't know if super fails. Super fails might be too harsh for what I'm about to talk about, but I saw a movie that's out right now called Goodnight Mommy. That's an Austrian art house film, and I love the concept of this movie, basically the concept is that this mother comes home from some kind of surgery, and she has bandages all over her face, so you can barely see her face. You can just see these sort of two eyes out of the swollen flesh, and her two young twin boys are suspicious. They're like, this isn't our mom, because she's acting different. She's being much more harsh and mean to them, and she stops talking to one of them, and so... That's a great concept, and I was really interested to see what they would do. So, like, for the first half of this movie, I was, like, pretty into it. And I have to say, it starts with one of the creepiest opening sequences I've seen in a long time, where all it is just this, like, old Aryan Nation movie or something, where there's, like, a bunch of kids in lederhosen, like, singing the song, and then, like, a woman in blonde, like, holding a baby, and she's saying, like, good night, mommy. And it's just creepy, okay? It's just, it has that weird, like, semi-Nazi feeling. And, but the movie, for me, kind of takes this turn, without giving anything away, that it just goes into, like torture porn, pretty much. And I just
Austria is where we get our torture porn now, apparently.
I just shut really down with that. I just stuff. Can't I couldn't I just couldn't hang in there. You know, I sort of just shut down and like kind of like was not even like looking at the screen that much anymore. And I, you know, I looked over at David and we were sort of both like, should we just leave? You know, like this is so like awful. Like it wasn't fun. I mean, that's the thing I think about with horror movies too. There always has to be this kind of like joy to it, as demented as that sounds.
Yeah.
But like a joy in like deranging our senses. But it just was like sick and depressing after a while. And
like the Babadook was like that too.
At like the most tired moment, when Stephen King was most worn out in the early 90s, there was this one called Sleepwalkers that was about these two sort of like vampire cat people who had been around since
Egypt,
and they were like super hot, both of them. The thing is they never showed you once a successful killing. And I remember just being so dissatisfied. What the fuck am I watching this for if you're never going to show me these things doing what they're supposed to do?
Yeah.
Now I'm just, much in the way that I would always get sad about the coyote never getting to eat the Roadrunner, I was very, very sad for these poor people that they, these poor cat beasts, weren't able to just kill a nice virgin the way that I wanted them to.
Oliver, all cat beasts deserve such a thing.
Oliver, any tropes that you're tired of?
I think definitely I would second torture porn. Where, I mean, I sort of get the appeal insofar it's a voyeuristic thing, right? It's basically like the closest we'll get to like a snuff film that's not actually a snuff film, and that's part of it. But I've never really found the appeal myself. I was trying to think of super fails in terms of like sort of overrated horror movies. I mean, the one that came to mind, and it's not like it was a huge fail, but it was the Bram Stoker Dracula that had Keanu in it, which the art direction was great. But it was just not really that great story-wise.
Well, there's something so fun about, like, rooting these things in, like, these romantic novels from, like, high romanticism aren't scary. Like, they're eerie a little bit, but also we didn't understand the technology that well because it was being invented. So, like, you know, Dracula the novel is just a bunch of data and a bunch of people going places.
It's true.
Getting scared for not a good reason. It's not like a thing happens. People just become overwhelmed with a sense of fear and then they run away.
Can I say something? Because I forgot I watched it yesterday until you brought it up. A lot of stuff happened this weekend. But the one thing that I love about that movie, it's not, I feel bad because Keanu just got a straight up bad rap. And you can tell when you look in his eyes how hard he's trying in that movie to just like stay.
That was the era where he was trying really hard.
He was trying really hard.
There was an era where Keanu tried really hard.
He knew that he was up against. But the one thing I love about that movie is Gary's performance. He's the tour de force. The one.
He was.
The costume changes, right. The aging, the reverse. Ugh, just like I fall in love with him more and more, no matter what he is and what phase he is as Dracula in the movie.
He's a treasure.
Let's talk about horror comedies or just sort of like horror rooted things that are just awesome. For instance, I don't think anyone is scared by The Craft, but I think we all understand that this is the month when we are allowed to watch The Craft and not say, Guy, you've watched this thing 1,000 times before. You don't need to watch it again. Right now, Shannon Tunney and Fairuza Balk, and I think Rachel True, need to
Robin.
Like...
Tunney.
Oh, Robin Tunney. Sorry. need to get together and make some magic. And then also, old school, like... Do any of you guys remember that in 1985 Fright Night?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, that movie was such a charming comedy. And also, before the Scream movies, which are also... The original Scream is everything I want from a horror comedy.
So good. Mm-hmm.
Like, it's magnificent deconstruction. Like, we basically had enough years of stand-up comics talking about, the black guy gets killed first, or any girl who has sex gets killed, that, like, seeing them in action with a nice, solid, like, feminist academic background sort of pushing things along was so good. But Fright Night also, like, really... loved horror movies, but also loved having a sense of play and humanity with them.
Monster Squad? Oh, sorry.
Oh, so good. When they realize that the only virgin they can find is that five-year-old, that's
that
the best.
Part, I didn't recognize that until I saw it recently, and it really bothered me.
Do either of you guys remember this movie?
No, I do not.
It's like a fun Goonies-style children's adventure where monsters come through a portal, but there are some really weird elements in it.
No, like, they came on a jet, guy.
I forget. All I know is there's an incantation that needs to be read in German for them to be banished, and it's a Holocaust survivor that they have who speaks German, and it's like playing with some interesting energies that a children's movie maybe shouldn't be playing with. And I want to go back and see it again if it's brilliant or really tacky.
It's on Netflix.
Well, I just saw recently, because I'm writing a piece about John Boyega, the star of Star Wars. So I went back and watched some of his older movies, and I saw Attack the Block. Mm-hmm. Have you guys seen that?
Yeah, I love
no.
it.
So Attack the Block is pretty fun, because the whole premise of that is that these aliens land in this,
working class part of London, right?
Yeah, even more down and out than working class. Like pretty
Seven Sisters. That's pretty much probably where they are.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's like these, you know, hood rats are like there in the neighborhood just like mugging this girl. And then this alien crashes down to the earth and they go and investigate. And basically the movie from there plays with the fact that these guys are like, they're like tough. They're like street. They're smart. They've got weapons. They know how to fight. But then these aliens are kind of like giving them a run for their money. But they don't want to give up.
Yeah.
And in a way, it's like, oh, yes, these are the perfect people to battle an alien invasion because they don't give a shit. You know what I mean? They're just like, here's another thing that I have to like wreck.
They're down
no problem. Yeah. It's from the same producers as Shaun of the Dead. So it has that same kind of like...
Edgar Wright-ish sort of feel.
Yeah, and like kind of a lot of wink-wink to the script and a lot of inside jokes and, like teenagers who just say incredibly like caustic London-y things about watching Skins and, you know, texting their friends and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, it's great.
I was thinking of a film that I think really haunted me as a kid, but if I were to watch now, I'd find hilariously bad, which was The Blob in the 70s.
Mm-hmm. Oh, loved The Blob.
And the idea that where the scene where the blob enters into a bowling alley and is basically killing people, but the blob doesn't move that fast. So there's some guy in a wheelchair.
The blob moved faster in the 87 version.
Oh, see, they made fast blob versus slow blob, like zombies. We had that.
Right. The blob, though, I feel like is one of those tropes where like you see the person who just cannot run fast.
Right.
All. Like, they just are like, oh, it's coming for me.
Well,
and, like,
that's why
taking
really...
one step per minute.
Sorry. This is a really exciting topic for me.
No, go for it.
Go in.
The American Werewolf in London is my favorite horror comedy, mainly because of David Naughton's portrayal of, like, sort of your average American dude on travels. You know, he's on holiday with his best friend at the moors in England. And just to be, like, they set the movie up so they're just hanging out. And then all of a sudden this catastrophic thing happens that they were warned not to do. And that's ends up him getting bitten by the werewolf. And then the transformation scene is just sort of like the conversation they have about Americans being on holiday and how they don't listen. They're stubborn. They're annoying. They're obnoxious. And then this happens. And now he's to blame. And now we know. And it's just the movie really starts and then it just really ends. But the transformation scene to this day.
Like steering into the shitheadedness is so important. And it's not the Goonies if you don't explain to him 1,000 times.
Right.
Or not the Goonies, not Gremlins, if you don't explain 1,000 times that you should not feed them after midnight. Why are horror movies, why do they mean so much to teenagers? And why are they so closely associated with teenage sexuality?
Well,
metaphor?
I just... I just saw It Follows, which I know you saw, and I loved it, I have to say. And it's very saturated in just teenager mind. And part of the story with It Follows is that, you know, this thing gets passed along sexually. Like, the minute you have sex with somebody that has this thing following it, it now follows you. And the thing that's following you takes many different forms. But, you know, I think it is about, like, breaking into a new world, right? A new reality. When you're a teenager, you are going through these changes where you are like the werewolf, like, all of a sudden growing hair and whatever. And so I think it does make this handy metaphor for just teenage life in general. Like this crazy metamorphosis that you have no control over.
And also a creation of predation dynamics in your life, like where boys really are hunting after something and maybe breaking laws along the way, and like girls are fearing that something will be stolen from them. It is creepy and interesting, the messages that are sent, but also let's give big ups to Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and both in movie and TV form, really taking that aspect of the narrative and saying, no, this girl having like a determined sense about her own life means that she is the one in charge. She is the chosen one.
Except that she sleeps with her boyfriend and the boyfriend turns evil as a result. So,
yes.
Well, but you know, if you look at Nightmare on Elm Street, Nightmare on Elm Street had the same problem, but that was the first movie to really look at kids with serious problems, like alcoholic parents, parents who are absent. And now this, I always talk about that because it's so fascinating. Well, Wes Craven, you know, rest in peace, he painted really fascinating characters.
The two things we haven't really talked about and we need to wrap up but are slasheriness and then Korean water demons. Like, I feel like those are the two schools of horror. But also, like all of the stuff that's come out of Japan in the past 15 years with The Ring and other stuff that I didn't watch. And do any of you have any strong feelings about either slasheriness or Korean water demons?
I tried to watch the Japanese, like the original Ring, and it was so scary I couldn't do it.
Yeah, it's pretty
fucked up. Like, I stopped after like 20 minutes and I was like, no, I just can't.
Besides The Host, what are the other Korean water demon movies? Which I think The Host was actually that good. So.
Oh, was that the one?
Yeah.
And then I just know about it from the SNL sketch. and then did The Ring have a little girl who crawled around, or that was just
there
you
was
watch
like
a video?
There was definitely like a drenched Japanese girl like from the river or something.
See, these are the names that I'm talking about. All right. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We will be right back after this.
Hi, everybody. I'm Justin McElroy.
I'm Travis McElroy.
I'm Griffin McElroy.
And we host the first podcast ever made, My Brother, My Brother, and Me.
Every Monday, we put out the first ever advice comedy podcast ever.
They found our podcast on Dead Sea Scrolls.
We're the Hammurabi Code of podcasts, and we're ready to entertain you with jokes that we invented, the first jokes.
So join us every Monday on MaximumFun.org.
You'll never crack our code, Dan Brown. Just try me.
It's history in the making.
And in the faking. And it's all yours for the taking.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Winter Mitchell,
Margaret Wappler,
and Oliver Wang.
Oliver, what's that question we ask every week on Pop Rocket?
What is your jam?
Oliver, what ding, 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 ding. Is your current jam?
So I have a mini Halloween themed jam, which is I haven't read it yet, so I'm going to go on a limb and predict it's going to be really good. But Frank Shong, who is a reporter for the LA Times, did a profile on a Korean company that does costumes that used to do lingerie, and they have taken credit for inventing the whole sexy Halloween costume.
Oh,
thing.
They can't take credit
see,
for
but
that.
But see, I want to read this piece, so I'm gonna predict this might be a jam, but we'll see when it comes out. My actual jam is Timmy Thomas's Why Can't We Live Together from 1972, a.k.a. basically the entire song that Drake remade with Hotline Bling.
Like I didn't pick that. I got a Drake dance to it.
We out here in wine country. Did you guys read that whole New York scene breakdown?
Yes.
So brilliant.
This one is my favorite. Like, I'm almost going to throw a football, but I'm not.
Yes.
Is this fun?
It is. And the thing is, the thing I love about, I think Hotline Bling is actually a great song in and of itself. I love the fact that it's been memed a million times over. I love the Erykah Badu remix of it. I'm not that
Ooh,
into the
I
Sam.
Listen to that.
It's great, actually. The Sam Sweet version is whatever. I could do without that, but Erykah killed it. But I also love that it's bringing attention back to Timmy Thomas. And this was a big hit for him back in the early 1970s. And the thing about not just this song, but the Timmy Thomas album is, I could be certainly wrong about this, but I think it was probably the first kind of major release in which every single track uses a drum machine on it. And he's using the Maestro Rhythm King, which is the same drum machine that Sly Stone used on There's a Riot Going On. And people like Shuggie Otis and Timmy Thomas, I think, were clearly following Sly's lead. And, you know, the Rhythm King by contemporary standards was an incredibly primitive drum machine, but there's something about the primitiveness of it that really worked with music of the time because it just gives it this kind of rawness to it. And this, I mean, not just Thomas's song, but the whole album, which I went back to listen to after listening to Hotline Bling, is fantastic. Like, it's a great album, and his use of the drum machine is phenomenal on it. And I'm glad Thomas is hopefully getting some nice checks off of this, but I also want people to go back and re-listen to the album that the song is inspired.
Winner, what's your jam this week?
Used To by Mute Math. I went to see Mute Math. I saw Vaults and I saw Tower all in one night last week. And I was blown away by every single band's set. And then I also ended the week with Empire of the Sun, which is always a good time. But Used To by Mute Math, this awesome band that I don't know enough about them, the behind the scenes. I need to read up on them, but I love what they're doing. And they're amazing live. This is Quadrant on Fuego. This is such a great song. I just want to make out with someone to this the entire time.
If you started to try to clean while listening to this, you would just start having sex. Someday.
Exactly. With something. I love them. And they were so sexy last week at Echoplex. It was like a hot, sweaty room, and I was bouncing back and forth.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah, it was good.
I feel like this is from a movie about bad West Side rich teenagers at night doing
yes!
things that they're not supposed to be doing.
Exactly.
God, I love it.
It is a little bit Frank Ocean, actually, on that vibe tip.
Yes.
Yes.
Margaret Wappler, what's your jam?
I have a jam from It Follows. This is the theme to the movie by Disaster Piece. I know, it's so good.
I love you for this.
He's also known as this electronic music mastermind, Rich Vreeland. So this just has so many great, like, 80s John Carpenter synthy creepy vibes. Mm.
This is definitely going to get sampled on Kanye's new album. I'm just going to call it right now.
Yeah. I'll give you $50 gift card to Chili's.
Not TGIF?
Not TGIF.
Wait, is that supposed to be dangling? Are you dangling
yes.
an incentive?
You're going to take
I don't know
it.
If...
You got to get some bacon skins. I mean,
yeah.
Those are good.
Bloomin' onion.
That is eerie.
And now I'm going to murder all of you.
Yeah, I knew it was coming.
She's going to show us her using her life as a way to get to reviews. Colin, will you play a clip of my jam?
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm here with...
Oliver Wang.
Winter Mitchell.
And me, Margaret Wappler. And I'm wondering from you guys, what new shows have caught your attention, and which ones do you think are probably heading for cancellation already?
I think I can dance to this jam.
Yeah. I like it. All quadrants.
It hits all quadrants. I just wanted to use my jam time for... I didn't get to have the new TV conversation with you guys. And I felt really particularly bad that, Oliver, you watched two episodes of Quantico and had no one to talk to about it.
It's not a shitty show. It's not great, but it's not bad.
The thing is I watched that show, and it's a terribly made show. It is like How to Get Away with Murder, but worse. And I will watch every episode of this season. And I did not watch every episode of How to Get Away with Murder. Mm. I mean, it is
I'm so lost.
It is attractive young people mm-hmm. going to a school that we can all pretty much be like, that's not how that kind of schooling works. And then they have committed some sort of crime and they are having to figure it out amongst themselves and there are time leaps, all of these things. And it's, I am legitimately like, well, which one is it? And like, I feel like I will stay on board for that. Mm. And the question I have for you is, has Priyanka Chopra made the jump from Bollywood acting to Hollywood acting?
Ew.
Because I think that things are still a little...
Silk stockings?
One note, yes. like, there's a lot, there's a lack of subtlety. What are your thoughts?
Well, I've only watched those first two episodes. I think she's fine on it. I mean, you know, but it's one of those things where I think, as I said last week, it just feels really formulaic in a very kind of very particular kind of network action, you know, mystery, whatever. I mean, I don't know, you probably could describe it in a more eloquent way, but I just feel like I've watched the show in some variation before. She's fine so far, but
Would you say that she has two significant talents? That she has two significant talents.
Right.
Is that like a boob reference?
Yes. Yes. Oh, okay. Also her hair. Let's count her hair as a third significant talent.
I put her hair. I don't know.
A pair of boobs, so you get one more.
Yes. She is fantastic to look at.
No, she's beautiful. She's just a little like in a Bollywood movie, if you are sad, there's not much going on underneath the sadness. Your job is to be sad then. And that's kind of still what she does. Mm. Margaret, to you, I wanted to briefly discuss the grinder and the fact that it's amazing. But did you watch Grandfathered at all?
No.
And the weird, but I feel like that it's primarily just valuable for the thing of they're a lot serving up the same stuff. Guy that we love, like they air back to back. It's guy that we love being taken out of his element and being made to the humor is that he is not being the thing that he is set up to be. And the grinder is so much better than Grandfathered, and Grandfathered is getting slightly better ratings. And it
That's frustrating.
A terrible situation of they can't keep both of them because it is actually a terrible situation.
We need to rectify this.
They canceled a sitcom that aired then. I don't exactly remember which one it was. It's the one that I work for, which was getting like solid mid-2 ratings, and now they have they're showing a show that gets like I think Grandfathered was getting like a 1, and The Grinder was getting a 0.9, and that's real rough. And it's hard. And one of the things you guys talked about was the way that networks are still canceling things as though it were 1996. They're still pulling things off the air because they're like, ah, that's not working. And then they put something on to replace it, and it gets a third of the ratings of that. And not just understanding that maybe if they had stuck with some of the things that they had tried.
Yeah, let it grow.
Yeah, and it's a really hard situation to see where, you know, maybe it is better that network TV is killing itself and we'll be forced to understand what a Netflix and Hulu world looks like. But that's also a little bit worrisome because those shows don't have the same kind of ratings pressure. And we're getting a second season of Grace and Frankie, and I don't think anyone wants that.
I do.
Oh, really?
All right. What about Scream Queens?
Oh, I still haven't watched Scream Queens.
You've made references like you have, though.
I made a mean joke.
Like, and that is, to me, is offensive because I would have expected of all people in this room for you have to have at least watched 2.
I mean, I need to.
You need to love it.
I need to watch Scream Queens because there are some people who I really respect who are telling me that I would love it and some people who are saying it's the worst thing that they've seen. I think.
You are going to love it, and
I already
know
it. I think it is serving up exactly the American Horror Story I want.
It's okay.
You have been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Winter Mitchell, Margaret Wappler, and Oliver Wang. We'll post show notes every week at MaximumFun.org. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to Medj G, Brioche Please, Just Like You, Drama Khaleesi, SRB4887, Ducky22, Elisa Tay, Carrie G76, Cormus, Jen SLC, Breeze 202, and Black Mirror for the 5-star reviews on iTunes.
What up, guys? Black Mirror?
I think for our year-end awards, we definitely have to do one for best 5-star review name.
Oh, God. That's a really great point.
What was the one?
Yep.
Get in touch with us on Twitter at Pop Rocket. Join in with the conversation on our Facebook group. This week, tell us what's the whitest or most notable discrepancy between the picture you created in your head of a person based solely on hearing their voice and what they actually look like. Also, while we do that, let's be respectful of people, okay?
I keep thinking you're saying whitest.
I thought you were saying whitest, too.
And the whitest. We're a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producer is the very Colin. I look for Cockney rhyming slang to in some way insult you. But I couldn't. The very posh Colin Anderson.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.